from the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Before I get into today's interview, I just want to briefly repeat that I'm doing a book giveaway. If you're interested in one of the books you've heard about on this show, you may go to my website, shelaughswithoutus.com, and use the contact tab to ask me for my copy. If you're the first to ask, and I still have the book, and you live in an area with domestic U.S. postal rates, I will send it to you. So I'm so excited. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear a live in-studio conversation with Vermont author Susan Z. Ritz, whose debut novel, A Dream to Die For, has just come out from She Writes Press. Susan's actually been on the show once before. She was one of four authors who I interviewed for the 100th episode of Write the Book, and we're going to talk about that a little later. Susan Z. Ritz grew up in Minnesota, but she left home to become a wandering scholar. She lived, studied, and worked as a social worker in Kenya, Japan, Singapore, and Indonesia in the 1970s. She worked as a human rights lobbyist in Washington, D.C. during the Carter administration before moving to Dachau, Germany, the setting for her memoir In Progress, On the Edge of Dachau. For the past 30 years, she has lived with her husband and three children in Montpelier, Vermont, where she has worked as a fundraiser, events coordinator, and philanthropic advisor for a wide range of nonprofit organizations, especially those promoting economic equality for women. Writing has always been her passion, and after receiving an MFA in creative nonfiction from Goucher College, she began writing for local publications, teaching creative writing to adults and high school students, and working on her first novel, A Dream to Die For. Here's a little information about the book. In Riverton Falls, bartender Celeste Fortune stands in her kitchen puzzling over last night's frightening dream. A woman at a window, bushes blowing in the breeze, someone's hands tightening around her neck. She is sure the dream belongs to someone else. Perhaps she has finally broken through to the collective unconscious of the Dreamland group. She heads off into a cold November morning to see her therapist, Larry, who also happens to be Dreamland's leader, hoping he will help her untangle the images. But when she arrives for her appointment, Celeste finds Larry dying in a pool of blood, skull crushed by his own healing crystal. His computer, meanwhile, which contains the intimate dreams and secrets of half the town, is gone. Suspicion immediately falls on Celeste, known to be a rebellious dreamer. To clear her name, she enlists the help of her old friend, Gloria, and the two women set out to find the real culprit, unwittingly making themselves the killer's next targets. So Susan Z. Ritz is here with me in the studio. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi, Shayla. Good.
It's exciting to have you in the studio and on the show again. So this book came out last week, but you are launching tomorrow night at Bear Pond Books.
That's right.
In Montpelier.
Can't wait.
What time does that happen?
That's going to be at 7 p.m.
Okay, awesome. So before we talk in detail about the book, I was wondering if you might like to start by reading from it.
Sure.
Okay.
I'm going to read the very first chapter.
Okay.
Morning in Riverton Falls. Celeste reached for the remnants of last night's dream. She'd woken, gasping for breath, throat raw and sore, as if she'd been screaming in her sleep. A woman at a window, bushes blowing in a soft breeze, a shadow coming at her from behind. She'd scribbled down the disjointed images in her journal before she'd even opened her eyes, but now the morning had whisked the rest away. Still, she couldn't shake the feelings of panic and guilt. She tried again to find a thread that would lead her back in, but it was too late. Battered old Mr. Coffee burped and spluttered the last drops of Java into the carafe. Celeste poured herself an oversized mug and stumbled back to bed to see what she could figure out. Propped against a pile of pillows, she opened the black leather notebook and sipped her coffee. Nothing in the trio of lines she'd scratched out in black ink explained why the dream left her feeling both frightened and ashamed. At least nothing she could figure out on her own. She wondered what Larry would make of this dream, the last she would share with him after 4 years of therapy. All that time, Celeste had tracked her dreams, learning to decipher the letters and words she'd jotted down, often with eyes still closed, on the unlined pages of her journal. She'd poured out hundreds of these dreams. Some just scraps or a single startling image, others pages long like surreal short stories. But now, If she could stick to her plan, she was done. Today was the day she was going to tell him she was quitting, and there was no way he was going to talk her out of it again. She'd had enough of Larry Blatsky, his dreamers, and this thing called the Dreamscape, the thing Jake called a cult. Celeste tossed the journal onto the heap of library books, magazines, and last Sunday's New York Times that littered the floor next to her bedside of the bed. Jake's side was neat, uncluttered, as it had been since he'd moved out 6 weeks earlier. She rolled over onto the smooth, cool sheets. There was no trace of Jake there, no scent on the pillow, she hugged to herself. "Larry will destroy you," she remembered Jake saying the night he left as he jammed his clothes into his duffel bag. "This isn't a game, Celeste. He'll turn you into someone you don't know or even recognize. That's what he does. Believe me, I've seen it, and I can't stay and watch this happen to you." She shook her head, trying to dislodge the memory. If Jake were still there, lying where he'd been the whole 6 whirlwind months of their engagement, she knew she could go through with her plan. "Get down there and tell him it's over," he'd say, the calloused fingers of his guitar strummer's hands on her cheeks, pulling her face to his for a good luck kiss. But without Jake to back her up, though, Celeste wondered if she had it in her. She'd tried to stand up to Larry before, but she'd always left her therapy sessions feeling defeated and hopelessly mired in what he called her demon mind, the labyrinth of self-loathing and doubt Larry had unearthed and then used to control her. "Not this time," she thought, getting up to raise the shade to the wan November light. Larry wasn't going to win while she still had a chance at happiness. She'd waited too long for the enlightenment he'd promised. Now all she wanted was love. She was going to get Jake back in her bed where he belonged.
Thank you for reading that. I want to ask you if you think dreams hold important information.
Yes, I do. I was in dream therapy myself for 15 years. Uh-huh. And I learned basically how to decipher them for myself after a while. But I think what they show is what's really going on underneath all your thoughts, all the things that you've been thinking about all day, and all the things that trip you up. And that's what I think dreams told me the most. Like, what were my stumbling blocks? What were the things that really triggered me? And what were the things that I was hiding from everybody, including myself?
Okay, great. And then I also wanted to know if you find it difficult to write about dreams. Like, I was really struck in reading this. Those initial images, it's really... I like how you just give us these images and then she talks about her reaction to them, but you don't give us the whole dream as a narrative blow by blow. So,
yeah. I don't think I really made that conscious decision, but I realized when you put in a whole block of dreams and it's like this italicized thing and comes out like a story, that's not really how we dream. And
we really
dream in little fragments. And while you're dreaming it, you think it makes perfect sense. But if you try to tell somebody else about your dream, it's like, well, and then I was standing at a bus stop and then a motorcycle came along and I was on the moon. So there's no sense until we actually start to analyze them and think about them and make them into something that makes sense to us and makes sense to other people. So I had a whole lot of opportunity to do that. So the only dreams that are really in these italicized things are little teeny fragments, which we dream in frequently. Just that's all we can remember usually when we wake up, is just those little bits. Sometimes we can remember more. So I had the opportunity to have all my characters interpret their dreams because they're in a dream cult and they talk about dreams all the time and they write down their dreams and they go to the therapist about their dreams. So I got all my dreams across through different devices of fiction that we use for everything.
Wonderful. Yeah. Okay. Now, I was struck, and actually you just read this part, but I was struck early in the book by Larry's use of the term demon mind. It's described as the labyrinth of self-loathing and doubt that Larry uses against his patients even as they come to feel stronger. And he also he gives them forced hugs, and he has just a complete lack of boundaries, so unlike what one expects from a therapist. So I wonder if you can talk about designing Larry's character, figuring out who he was.
Oh, Larry's character. Well, I didn't want him to be like a totally evil person because that's not very interesting.
Right.
So I wanted him to be somebody who people could be attracted to so that my readers could understand why they fell under his power. And so I had to show him in his kindlier moments And then I had to show how he took apart my character Celeste piece by piece. And part of that taking apart was good. Like, he opened her up. She hadn't been able to love. She hadn't been able to ask for help. She was completely closed off, and that's why she went to him. But as he took her apart, she fell in love. She started reaching out to people, and that meant he lost his power over her. So I had to show him become this demonical controller, and that was really fun to do. I just kind of took him as a little short guy. I had to imagine him in my head. What did he really look like? What would that look like in sitting behind a desk? What would that look like moving around? What would that look like in some of these really surreal scenes that I have? I just got to make him from compassionate man to total evil. And yeah, that's a really fun character to write.
Yeah. And the other thing that's really fun about him, and I'm not going to give anything away with this, but the surreal things that you've just mentioned, you know, it's interesting to see how he wants to come across to people, how he wants to look to people. And it's got a lot to do with power. And I won't go too deeply into it, but it's pretty cool. Now, her nervousness about ending her therapeutic relationship with Larry, which you touch on just there in that reading you did, it makes for great suspense even before the mysteries really begin. And as the back of the book says, so I'm not giving anything away, we soon learn that Larry is murdered. So, but the small suspense that starts the book, where she's nervous about quitting her therapeutic practice with him, it's great. It kind of puts us on the edge of our seat, but also like makes us a little off balance and a little worried for her before anything really intense happens. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about building suspense on both small and large levels in a mystery.
Again, I don't know, some of it's so unconscious, and some of it was based on my own experiences. So building the small suspense is just it's the nervous things inside of us and bringing them out to the surface. Like for her, it was like, he's not going to do it again. You already knew that there was tension there, that she'd tried this before, that she was really steeling herself, and it just came across through tiny little thoughts.
Right.
But then the bigger suspense moments, like car chases, which there are some in this book, they were really, really fun. But I had to make sure I wrote shorter sentences, faster action, and have something really mysterious that you're not quite sure what's going on. You kind of think you know what's going on, but you're not sure. And that keeps you going to read to find out what's next. Why did this happen? How did it happen?
Right, right. Now, you do a great job of offering little hints and clues as far as what did happen or what might have happened or what might not have happened. So I wondered if that is very intentional when you're writing a mystery, or do you find that that just happened really organically as you wrote? Like, did these sort of clues and hints crop up just as part of the writing process and surprise you along the way? Or did you have to, as you revised, go back and say, okay, I really want to put something here that makes the reader wonder about, let's say, this character or that character?
Okay, well, first of all, I was not a big mystery reader at all.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why I wrote a mystery. But like everybody else, you know, I've seen mysteries on movies and TV, and I listened to books on tape. So I kind of knew the flow of it. I wrote this book, the first draft, I had no idea who murdered Larry.
Okay.
I had no idea until I got to the end. So then when I got to the end, I had to figure out, okay, who else could have done this? Because once I knew who did it, I had to make that person a little bit invisible. Like, you know, in most things, it's always the person you expect the least.
Right.
But I had to have everybody else be a suspect. So everybody else had, I had a big whiteboard, and I put all the names of the characters on one side, and then I did a line of why they could have done it, where they were when they could have done it, and why they could have done it. And then I had another line of they didn't do it, and why they couldn't have done it. So that really helped me figure it out. But I knew that red herrings were really important to a mystery book. And it also was a great way to develop the characters themselves, because they all didn't come out as, nobody's super good or super bad. Everybody's flawed, and everybody's got a stake in the murder of Larry.
Yeah. Okay, great. That was my reaction. Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I read a paragraph and then we can talk about it? Okay. So this is as Celeste is leaving the police station with her friend Gloria. "Celeste," a voice called. Beneath the street lamps, leaning against a parked car, two dreamers waited. Even from the steps of the station, Celeste could hear Ingrid's Swedish-accented murmur, although you didn't just hear it when I said it, but oh well. Her husband, Bill, stepped forward into the light that leaked from the station doors behind Gloria and Celeste, his bald head and fringe of white hair glowing in the harsh fluorescence. She should have guessed they'd be here. Nicole never went anywhere without her cadre of Dreamland guards. "What happened, Cell? What did you do to Larry?" the two asked in unison, Bill's husky, rumbling voice almost drowned out by Ingrid's almost hysterical screech. Had they come to blame her or to claim her? She couldn't tell. Let's see. "So I have to go talk to them, Gloria. I want them to believe me." And Gloria says, "Don't be an idiot. They're not your friends." "What do you mean? Of course they are. They know me better than anyone. I have to convince them." "If they really knew you, they would already know you're innocent. You didn't have to convince me. Remember, the dreamers are loyal to only one thing, the dreamscape." And I'm going to stop there. But I love how you are able to take ancillary characters and develop them to fill out the story and move the plot forward. And Bill and Ingrid are just two of very many characters in this book. So I wonder if you can talk about the smaller characters that we get to know them a little bit. We see them here and there, and how that helped you develop your plot.
They were the fun part because I've lived in Montpelier, Vermont for 30 years, and I kind of wrote this as a little love letter to my town and to the people in my town, and I wanted them to be in my book.
Yeah.
So I thought of, nobody is exactly who they are in real life, but they're composite characters. But what I got to do was think about my friends and think about people that I see every day in Montpelier, maybe the librarians and the doctors and the people who work at the laundromat, and just try to figure out who are they really. And I got to look inside their lives or a little bit, or make them funny, add something to them. Like, I have a librarian who has cat hair all over his shirt all the time, and it says, "I love cats" on his sweatshirt or something. And that's something that I might see on this person, but it's just something I knew about him. And I thought, I'm going to make him a cat lover. And so it was just fun taking people I knew and spoofing them up a bit.
Okay. All right. Now, and the town in the book is called Riverton Falls, and I love the town. It's got an herbal apothecary and a feminist art gallery, band concerts on the green, indie bookstores, small movie house. And it's like the perfect setting for a cozy mystery, which I would say this is. Mm-hmm. So why did you not call it Montpelier? Or did you want your own town, and did you distinguish it in lots of ways from Montpelier?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. First, I didn't want people to recognize some of the people in it by the town. Other people, it was fine. But and another reason is I kind of wanted to expand the reach of the novel.
Yeah.
And so if I made it Northern New England, there are so many towns like Montpelier in Northern New England, and anybody could think about it as their town. It could be any little town in Northern New England.
Right.
So I didn't want to ground it in one place. I wanted people to imagine their own town when they were thinking about this.
Right. Okay. Now, Celeste's own path of discovery leads us through the narrative, and I really like that. One important aspect of her character is her vulnerability and her insecurities. She has lots of questions, and that's what sent her to Larry in the first place. It's a very important part. This vulnerability, I think, is very vital to the plot. And then some people, and I think Larry's included in this, they take advantage of that, and they really, like, hurt her. And so I just thought that was really important to her character. And I was going to just, if you don't mind, I was going to read one more little thing here. Mm-hmm. How could she tell Gloria all that had happened over the past year since Jake had come into her life? All about her doubts, the loneliness of keeping them to herself, about her attempts to talk about them with Bill and Ingrid, about their rebuffs, the way they threw it all back at her, as if questioning was simply her inability to see the truth of the dreamscape. Her demon mind, they'd warned, before giving her that pitying, judgmental look, as if they had the keys to the kingdom, and as if she obviously hadn't worked hard enough to get there yet, as if she hadn't done her homework, hadn't delved far enough into her pain, had let her head get in the way of her heart. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And I think that her vulnerability allows her to ask a lot of questions, and that is what builds the narrative. Like, the questions bring us through the narrative. And actually, her friend Gloria, I think, is an answer person. So that dynamic is really cool. I don't even know if I have a question about this, but do you feel like her vulnerability helped you write the book?
It's so funny because I just wrote how I felt. I've been in a lot of situations that I put Gloria in. I mean, I put Celeste in and Gloria. And I'd always wanted to explore what had happened to me in that situation of I wasn't in a cult, which Celeste was. But I did go through a period when I was in dream therapy of being surrounded by everybody else who was in dream therapy. And that section you just read happened to me when I started questioning why I'm going to this therapist. And everybody I knew was going to this therapist. And it was really hard to break through some of the brainwashing, I guess.
Yeah.
But I didn't even think about Celeste until I started reading some of the reviews that come through. Celeste is a flawed and vulnerable character. I'm like, oh, that's me. I don't look at myself that way, but I guess I do. And I presented parts of myself that I maybe don't present all the time. It was really going deep into my own feelings and also just trying to figure out what had happened to me over those 15 years and how did I extract myself.
Okay. We're going to step away from the plot for 1 second, and I want to talk about your publishing journey. How did you find a publisher for A Dream to Die For?
Well, I am 65 years old, and I knew there was not an agent out there wanting to take one 65-year-old woman with one book. And I didn't want to wait 3 years looking for one, and I didn't want to wait for them looking for a possible publisher. And I remembered that I'd been on a community for a long time called She Writes, and I decided, oh, let's just go back and check on that and see if maybe they have some information. Oh, they have a She Writes press. Oh, my gosh. And it has been the best experience. She Writes press is a new kind of press, and it's called a hybrid press. So what it is you submit your book, and they decide whether or not, you know, there's many different levels of them accepting it. I was accepted right away, and I was really excited about that.
Yeah.
But they, I pay up front. They give me a traditional publishing experience, which means I went through all the things I would with a traditional publisher. They gave me the great cover. They helped me figure out a title, and offered all this support, unbelievable numbers of webinars, and understanding how BookBub works, and how Amazon works, and how Ingram, my distributor, works, and all the ins and outs of publishing that I don't think I could have gotten anywhere else. And they create a beautiful product. This year they won the Indie Press of the Year award from New Generation, which is the big award. And the publisher, Brooke Warner, is now head of the Independent Publishers board. And she is just a dynamo out there fighting for this new kind of publishing that lets people who don't have a platform and don't have celebrity status and may not be known by anybody actually publish because they've written something that's worth other people want to read.
Right.
And her belief in women is just tremendous, and her belief in writers is so heartening.
Yeah. And they do have, I should just point out, and you already sort of said this, but they have like a filtration system, I guess I should say, or a gatekeeper. So when your book first comes to this is not self-publishing. This is a book being read by professionals and deciding if it's ready to go. And if it's not ready to go, then they offer you those kinds of services. But your book did not need those yet at that point. So it's really interesting. It's an interesting business model.
Yeah, I think there's more and more publishers that are going into it. And my publicity team is Rootstock, which is a new Vermont hybrid publisher in Montpelier, and they've been putting out a lot of great books by Vermont authors. And I think this model is going to really work because there's five big publishers.
Yeah.
And if you don't have the, I didn't know how to get it. I didn't want to work on a cover, and I didn't want to work on all this stuff myself. I wanted somebody to help me. I knew I needed help, and this was the way to get it.
Excellent. Now, as I said earlier, you were on the show once before, and I've known you for many, many years. We're in the same writing group. But you were in my show about emerging and as yet unpublished writers in 2010. And one thing that we discussed at that time was the length of time it can take to write a book and get published. And every single person who was interviewed on that episode talked about how it's hard. It's little understood by other people. Nobody understands how hard it is to, first of all, write a book and get it just the way you want it and then get a publisher. So I wonder now, given that your debut novel launches tomorrow, how you're feeling about the journey.
Long is right. I think you probably never heard another book the whole time you've been in the writing group.
That's not true.
Well, I think how I feel about the journey was, at first I started out not believing in myself, and I had no idea how to write fiction. I learned everything I know about fiction from the writing group, from Shayla and all the other wonderful women in my writing group. And I had to learn how to write character, how to do dialogue, how to create setting. I had every single thing I had to learn from scratch. So I went through 9 drafts.
Wow.
But each time I got another understanding of how fiction works.
Yeah.
And so it took me 10 years, but the last 2 years I said, damn it, you can't tell people for 10 years you're writing a book and then not finish it.
Yeah.
So I quit everything else I was doing and I holed myself up in my office. And those 2 years were really hard for me, but I got it done. And at the end, I just felt so proud of myself.
Yeah. I mean, it's a wonderful Wonderful accomplishment. Now, you also mentioned in that same episode your love of teaching. And I wondered if you still teach writing from time to time.
Well, because I spent those years holed up in my office, I kind of quit. I hope to go back to it someday. I teach mostly memoir because that's what I got my MFA in, and it's what I understand how to teach. I love people's stories. I love helping people tell their stories, and yet I have a really hard time writing memoir. So I'm really good at telling everybody else how to do it.
I
love seeing people come alive with their work and getting confidence in what they're doing and expanding what they think they know how to do.
Right.
So and I worked a lot with kids in creative writing and essays, and I got to know them so well, and that's part of the joy of teaching, is getting to know really intimately some really cool people.
Yeah. And I remember you said in that episode that you love telling your students to look for the surprise that will come along.
Oh, yeah.
And change the work, and how exciting it is for students when they realize that they can actually do this. Okay, let's see. I wonder if you have read any books lately that you would recommend.
Oh, yeah. I've been reading as much as I can. I'm a really slow reader, so it's amazing how many writers there are in my own town.
Yeah.
And so I've been trying to keep up with their work. So two of them have... I've read really recently are The Invited by Jennifer McMahon.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a really great ghost story if you're into ghost stories. And she's a master at creating young girls, teenage girls, rebellious girls, strong girls. And I just love those characters in her books.
Yeah.
And then another one by a local Montpelier author who is also a very prominent national author is The Silk Road by Catherine Davis.
Yes.
Which is, to me, a masterpiece. It's not a regular book. It's a dream. Entering that book is like walking into a dream, and that's the way to read it. Just lose yourself in it. Follow the images. Follow the path that she's taking you on and you don't know where you're going, and you don't need to know. You just go along with the story. And if you do that, you will have the most wonderful experience of this book. And then Milkman by Anna Burns. Mm-hmm. Those are both by Grey Wolf Press, which won the Man Booker Prize. I mean, I picked that up like 5 times and I went, oh my God, it's one paragraph, the whole book. How am I going to read it? But it's stream of consciousness and I cannot put it down. I love it. If you look at it and you're afraid of it, don't be. It will draw you into this young woman's life in the Troubles in Ireland in the 1970s and what it takes to stay alive and how terrorism wreaks havoc on families and your interior life and the truth, basically. So, and then I listened to some really great books, like Becoming with Michelle Obama, which was like, oh my God, I had Michelle Obama sitting in the kitchen with me while I cooked every night, and she became my best friend, and I just love her so much. I love that book, and she is a really good memoir writer. I hope she writes something else. And An American Marriage by Tayari Jones, which tells us so much about what's happening in this country with mass incarceration from a really intimate point of view between Celestial and Roy, and how the incarceration affects both of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Those are all wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I will be putting links to those on the website and tweeting them later. Now, what about writing? Are you working on anything new yet, or are you going to wait a little while you do your book tour?
Yeah, I'm waiting a little bit for my book tour to get going, but I'm really excited for it to get going so that I can get back to the office.
Yeah.
I have two ideas. One of them you mentioned, which is my memoir in progress and has been in progress for 20 years. and it's called On the Edge of Dachau, and it's about the 6 years that I lived in Dachau, Germany. And it's about how the ripples of World War II affected people still in the 1980s and affected people on a very personal level, including me and my husband. And it was a really difficult book to write, so I kind of keep putting it off, which is why I wrote a mystery in the first place. And so now I thought, well, maybe I'll write a prequel. So I have an idea for a prequel to A Dream to Die For, which would set Celeste and her friend Gloria in Indonesia, which is a place I lived, and it was another mystical kind of place, and I thought that would be a perfect follow-up to have that mystical element follow through.
Uh-huh. Okay, great. Actually, my next question, you sort of already touched on this, but I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think it's so important when you're writing a mystery to stay organized. And you were talking about your whiteboard. Mm-hmm. And so can you just talk a little bit more about how you tracked what was happening and what maybe gave you a challenge as far as staying organized in writing a mystery?
Yeah, the whiteboard really helped. I had another whiteboard. And I had to keep track of what I'd already said. That gets harder and harder the older you get. Like, what was happening in the beginning of the book and not getting there? But one of the things I did with the other whiteboard, and this is something I learned at AWP, mm-hmm. and I think you were in the same thing with me, somebody who took each little strand of their story and got different colored yarn, and each colored yarn they'd start out, and then you could follow them around. And I did that. So I attached them to characters and who was where at what time, because that was the hard thing, was like, how do I keep track of where that person was and where they were before, which had to do with why or why not they could have been the murderer. So that's how I did it. But the other way I did it was like writing it over 9 times and trying to figure out every time I went through what I'd said twice, what I'd said 3 times, what I'd missed. And I think that was it. It was just getting to know my material so well that I finally figured out how it all fit together into one piece.
Now, did each of those 9 drafts have different revision goals, or did you kind of start over each time with sort of the same, like, universal approach to fixing it?
Kind of both. Uh-huh. I did start over each time. I Catherine Davis, who wrote Silk Road, has helped me a lot on this book, and she said, you know, the best way to revise is just start from scratch. So every time I would take the old one and just start retyping it, but starting from scratch would change it completely. So I would go through, sometimes I would, one thing I would concentrate on character, and I'd take, look at all the characters, look at what they said, what they were wearing, where they were, and then I would go through and do setting. What's in the setting? What's missing here? And then I'd go through with dialogue, which was really hard. I learned a lot about writing dialogue in this. And then I'd just go through, like the last couple times would be basically copy editing. How many times did I use the word as in this paragraph? How many times did I use just on the last 2 pages? Like a million. Trying to find all the little flaws in the writing style So,
okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great. Now, you just mentioned dialogue, and I think that your dialogue's great. And I also think that writing dialogue isn't as simple as just imitating exactly what people say. So, mm-hmm. I wonder if you can, what did you learn about dialogue that made your dialogue better?
I learned a lot about dialogue when I was teaching my classes.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'd always give them, my students, the homework of go to a cafe and sit down and eavesdrop on the people next to you. So I did that myself. And what I realized, and which most writers realize, is that nobody answers a direct question with the answer.
Yeah.
And I also learned a lot about subtext and how people answer things in a way that shows what's going on with them, not with the person who asked the question. And we do that all the time. Nobody answers things exactly how they're asked. And we also leave things out a lot. So silence and missing, not answering the question are just as important as answering the question, because you can find out what the person's trying to hide, which is a big thing in a mystery.
Yeah.
And then making sure that the dialogue also had body language in it, because dialogue is never on its own. You're never just speaking, you're also moving, and a lot of what happens in the subtext comes through in the movement of the person.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's all good. And actually, I ask about dialogue sometimes, and I don't think anyone has ever talked about the body language, but that does go right along with it. That's mm-hmm. great. Let's see. Now, I know you had to do some research, because this book covers a lot of ground, and it's not just based on your own experiences or the things that you've seen in Montpelier, for example. You have lots of, like, I know that there's tarot in this, and I don't know if you knew about tarot before you wrote the book, and there are other things that you would have had to research. So do you want to talk a little bit about research?
Sure. Thank God for Google, as everybody says. Yeah. I was always sort of fascinated with computers and where they're going, and the fact that this computer gets stolen let me delve into that. So in this book, there's a lot about virtual reality and augmented reality. So I got to learn. I had to go online and really learn about holograms, and I went to a meetup group in Burlington, which was a meetup group for virtual reality. So I got put on the goggles and wander around, because everybody there is under 30 and a guy, but me. But I got the idea of how that worked, and if it would work in my book or not. And I found out a lot of magazines like Verge and Wired, and I got a whole training in something I had no idea about before, like, how all these things work and how they're different from each other. And then I had to figure out how would it work in the book. And a lot of things I realized couldn't work, so I just put them in and hope that nobody notices.
To some extent,
a lot of research into computer issues that are going on today, and what are we using computers for in our society, and where are computers taking us?
Okay, yeah, great. And I think it's really smart to go to the meetup group. Did you make contacts with people that you were then able to email questions to and stuff, or?
No, I just went like two or three times.
Yeah.
And then I figured it out, and so this is how it works, and this is why it doesn't work. And I also learned a lot about a really cool guy named Jerome Lanier, and he was sort of the basis for one of the main characters in my book. And if you ever want to learn about virtual reality, I would suggest looking up Jerome Lanier.
Okay, great. I have one other paragraph I wanted to read and then ask you a question about.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question about writing about a cult. And I actually just thought this was just lovely prose, apart from anything else. So I just wanted to read this, and then we can talk about writing about a cult. Is that fine if I read?
Yeah.
Okay. This is again from Celeste's point of view. She remembered how excited she'd been at her initiation into the Dreamers only 1 year ago, when she stood at this very same door on a cold November evening, her stomach knotted with anticipation. She'd waited in the foyer, adjusting the scratchy Mandarin collar of the floor-length crimson robe Nicole had draped around her shoulders. She could remember the doors opening, how Bill and Ingrid had escorted her like a bride to the center of the sanctuary, how otherworldly and ethereal it appeared, just like her own dreams. The room glowed glowed in the flicker of candlelight. The scent of cinnamon and cardamom enveloped her. The dreamers danced in their jewel-toned robes, circling around her, their whispered welcomes almost lost in the swish of silk. I'm going to stop there, but it's just lovely. And it's very seductive. You know, it makes me want to be in that room, which I think cults or you know, groups with a kind of, you know, group dynamic do seduce you into their experience. So I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about writing about that.
I just wanted, exactly what you said. I wanted it to feel like the place you wanted to be.
Right.
You know, this is what I everybody's in that cult and it's so cool. And, you know, I want to be one of them.
Yeah.
So it took Celeste a long time to get in there, and she did finally. And I just imagine what were the smells? What were the sounds? What would be the thing that would envelop you that felt like you were being brought into the middle of something really, really special, and that you become a star at last, and you get to belong to a thing at last. But the group, I wanted to create not individuals. I wanted to get the feel of a group and a group consciousness, and I think that's what you just read was my attempt to do that.
Yeah.
This group just sort of swirling around her, and you know how you don't really see individual faces; you just see a circle of at that point, love surrounding you. And how seductive is that?
Right. Yeah. And actually, I think the analogy of it feels like being in a dream is perfect, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. So I just have one last question for you. And then if you have a prompt, we'll ask for the prompt in a minute.
Okay.
But my last question is always asking for advice. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, and we've talked a lot about writing a mystery. And so, you know, I'm sure people will take your advice about how do you stay organized and the whiteboards and things like that. But if you were talking to somebody who just said, I think I want to write a mystery, what advice would you have for them?
Just sit down and write it. And I really, you know, I think if it's your very first time, I would advise to do it the way I did it. Just sit down and start writing it and not know where you're going and not know who did it, because it's so exciting to find that out. It's just so much more fun than already knowing where you're going. And for me, writing is finding out what you want to know, not writing about what you already know. And I wanted to know who killed this person.
Yeah.
So following that path really helped me. Maybe if you've already written a mystery, you're better able to make an outline. But the surprise has to come to you.
Yeah.
And if you want to make it a surprise for your readers, you have to feel surprised yourself. So all the surprises you can give yourself, and I can't tell you how many times I was like, whoa, where did that come from? but if I'd put it all out in a outline before I even started, I don't think I would have found all the little ins and outs and the secret things that I learned about all the people and all the way they were connected and all the possibilities that they had for being a suspect.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. That's great advice. And then I wonder if you have a writing prompt that you can suggest.
Yeah. Well, this is one I've used with a lot of my classes. So what I do is usually, so pick out a box of buttons or bows or some pieces of jewelry and pick two that are somehow different from each other. And now think about the people who wear these things or use these things, and then have them meet somewhere, like at a cafe, and hold a conversation that begins with, where were you last night?
Oh.
So
wow.
For my students, it really helps you develop a scene and a character, and you learn how to do dialogue that way, too. So setting, scene, character, and dialogue all in one prompt, and it's a great avenue into something that you might continue further down the road.
I love that. And I love that you're holding the thing that is associated with each of them too.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I want to just mention again, the name of the book is A Dream to Die For. It's published by She Writes Press and written by Susan Z. Ritz. And tomorrow night at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, Susan will be having her launch at 7 p.m. Susan, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I'm so glad that you're book exists.
Well, and thank you for all your help in getting it done.
Okay. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with Vermont author Susan Z. Ritz. I wanted to just mention that if you want to know more about Susan's work, you can find it on her website, susanzritz.com. That's a wonderful website. She's done a lot of work on it. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as always, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. And I just want to remind you that I am doing that book giveaway, and you can read more about that at my website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And you can also find the show there. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.